welcome to this event this evening. My name is Nick McGoran and I'm a political geographer here. And we welcome you to Newcastle University, an institution with a proud history of civic engagement. I work in the geography department, where we co-host the Tyneside Geographical Lecture, a lecture series going back to 1891. Our most recent lecture, which Patrick Coburn gave, on what should we do about Islamic State. 800 people attended. So this is clearly Britain's role in foreign policy is clearly a topic that ignites Newcastle. Being a geographer, I couldn't resist showing a map. Now this is a cartogram, and it shows the share that different countries have in the world in global gross domestic product. And I'm sure you'll agree it's a striking portrayal of the inequalities in our world. Western powers are disproportionately have a greater share of the world's wealth. And this throws up a number of questions. This throws up issues of violence and inequality in our world. And it also raises the question, how should Britain use our disproportionate share of wealth and power? What responsibilities does this entail? What implications does this have for our foreign policy? And that's the focus of this discussion this evening. It's organised by three groups. Stop the War, who have been campaigning in Newcastle nationally since 2001 against UK intervention in the so-called War on Terror. Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which campaigns for justice, peace and human rights of Palestinians. And the Politics, Space and Power Research Cluster of Newcastle University, which researches the spatialities of global power. I should say there's a fire escape at the back. Side. However, I feel this discussion is going to be so scintillating, it might be worth enduring a singe in for, so don't hurry. And I would like to hand over to the chair this evening, who is Dr. Kate Manzo. She is a senior lecturer in the geography department who works on international development. So over to you, Kate.
Thank you very much, Nick. Yes, I'm a colleague of Nick's. I'm also a political geographer, but my focus, my research area is international development. With a focus on Africa. And just on the question of IS, sadly I missed the Coburn lecture, but tonight on BBC Two at 9 o'clock is a documentary that follows their money trail, how they actually fund their activities. So rush home for 9 o'clock so that you can watch that. First of all, thank you all for coming. It's great to see such a mix of students, undergraduates, postgraduates, members of staff here, and also members of the general public and these organisations. So my job is to introduce the candidates and then basically run the question and answer and make sure everybody behaves themselves and nobody speaks for too long. So just warning you now. So I'll introduce the candidates, and then what will happen after that is each one of them has been given 2 minutes to basically lay out their strategic vision for Britain's place in the world. So not much to do in 2 minutes, okay? So be succinct. You can talk about foreign policy specifically or just a kind of more of a broad ideological perspective, however you want to approach it. I will start at this end and work my way down. Alex Snowden is representative from Stop the War and the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. A local school teacher, he's been an activist in the coalition since 2001, when it was founded in response to the invasion of Afghanistan and the commencement of the War on Terror. Also long-standing chair of Newcastle's Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which organises and campaigns in support of peace, justice and human rights for the Palestinians. Alison Worley, and I got that right, didn't I, is a representative from the Green Party, a parliamentary candidate for Newcastle upon Tyne North. Originally from London, she moved to Newcastle in 1988, and it says has not looked back since. She is a welfare rights worker in a neighbouring local authority, and until recently was a trustee of the Newcastle Law Centre for 15 years. Alison joined the Green Party in 2006, and was one of the candidates in the Euro elections last year. Chi Onwuara is the Labour rep, served as an MP for Newcastle Central and is standing for re-election. Born in Wallsend, grew up on Hillsview Avenue in Kenton and went to Kenton School before studying electrical engineering at Imperial College London. A chartered engineer, she worked in hardware and software development, production management, marketing development and strategy for a variety of mainly private sector companies in a number of different countries, UK, France, US, Nigeria, Denmark. And as a geographer, I'm very impressed. Her latest role before entering Parliament was as head of telecoms technology for Ofcom, the communications regulator. Next, we have Nick Mason from the Conservatives, who is also wearing... Oh, no, you're not the one wearing the green top, are you? You are wearing a blue top. Conservative candidate for Jarrow, first member of his family to go to university, since graduating with a politics, economics and philosophy degree from Oxford in 2001. Was one not enough? You have to do three subjects. He has worked in the charity sector. This includes 3 years at Amnesty International and running a number of development projects in Rwanda. Oh, very interesting. And domestically, he's been a local councillor and served as a trustee for a variety of charities, including those working with youth and people with learning difficulties. And last but not least, Greg Stone, who is in the green top from the Lib Dem party. Greg is one of our own. Greg studied politics at Newcastle University in the early 90s, including political geography under Peter Taylor, who, if you don't know, is a god, you know, in political geography. Has been a Lib Dem councillor since 1998 and is the Lib Dem election agent for Wendy Taylor in Newcastle East, who is otherwise occupied this evening. He stood for Parliament in the 2001 and 2005 general elections and in the Sedgefield by-election in 2007, where... You must have written this.
Yeah.
Where voters confirmed he was not the new Tony Blair. Okay, so, you know, an eminent panel we have before us. So I think I'll go in reverse order now for the 2 minute intro. So Greg, you're first, please.
Thank you very much for inviting me and apologies on behalf of Wendy, who's got another hustings this evening, so I'm stepping in for her. Liberal Democrats believe that British foreign policy should promote liberty and freedom, human rights, peace, democracy, trade, and countering the threat of global climate change. We're proud of having met our commitment to meeting the 0.7% GDP target for international aid budgets, and we're proud to have helped to achieve global agreements on cutting emissions, although clearly there is clearly a lot more to do on that front still. We've worked to support liberal values of equality, democracy, equality for women, LGBT people, and freedom of religion and conscience internationally. Liberal Democrats and government have been leading the work to end female genital mutilation in Britain and abroad. But we recognise too that we are currently in a complex, multifaceted, unstable international situation. There are significant threats to stability, including Russia's role on the geopolitical stage, China's role in East Asia, Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East and North Africa, the situations going on in Syria at present, the impacts of mass migration, climate change and globalisation. And for that reason, Liberal Democrats strongly favour an internationalist and independent approach, seeking to maximise where we can the British foreign policy influence through the EU and the UN, and using democracy and humanitarianism as our main weapons rather than trident and neo-imperialism. So that's my platform to start with.
Thank you. Okay, next.
Thank you very much. I suppose many of you will understand the Conservative policies because you've been living through them for the last number of years, and there's nothing too surprising. We are ultimately a very internationalist party. We recognise our role in the world. And I suppose there's a sense of what the Conservatism stands for. It's to say that fix what's broken, cherish which is not. What that leads me to think is that when we look at the world, there are absolutely instances where we need to intervene. And there are absolutely instances where it is simply not appropriate for this country to be intervening when there are domestic issues that are truly domestic. We recognise international law. And so my sense, and I hope that we'll explore this as we go through this evening, is to recognise that our foreign policy is one about diplomacy, it's one about international development, it is about defence, and indeed when defence is used in offence, but just the same way that democracy is the worst of all the options, except when you look at all the others, or the worst, democracy is the worst form of politics until you look at all the others. Similarly, there is something about war being something that we all loathe, we all hate, but every once in a while, sadly, we need to resort to force. My background, I was actually brought up in a naval family, and for those of you that are anti-Trident, get ready to throw your brickbats at me, because my father was in charge of weapons on Britain's first Polaris submarine, so I suspect you probably know which position I might be taking a little bit later. But I hope we'll explore some points as the debate goes on. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. The Labour Party's roots are in the Labour movement. And the Labour movement has historically been international, and particularly in the Northeast, internationalist, believing in a global brother and sisterhood of men and women in working to bring about betterment for all. Hence the fair trade movement, hence Newcastle support of campaigns for anti-apartheid and today in the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. A Labour government will take that forward by addressing by being a strong voice for the UK on the international scene, by being active and engaged in the different international organisations, by continuing with the 0.7% of GDP spend on international development, which we brought in, by remaining in Europe and being a strong voice for a reformed Europe and supporting the European ideals, by addressing international trafficking and modern-day slavery, by holding companies to account for their supply chain through better reporting and taking responsibility for international workers' rights, by supporting migrants coming here to ensure that they have their workers' rights, by leading, as we have already led, on climate change through going faster than the European Union's decarbonisation goals, and also by supporting and ensuring we have armed forces which learn from the lessons of the past but are not paralysed by the past and are ready to take up our international role. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alison?
Very much. Unfortunately, Green Party is not in government yet, but these are the following five factors that the Green Party would approach international relations with. We will make UK foreign policy genuinely independent based on the principles of shared responsibility, cooperative security and human rights. We support a holistic and consistent approach to peace and defence, focused on genuine peacekeeping and respect for the sovereignty of peoples across the world. We want to see a fundamental restructuring of our global economy. Power should be held at the local and regional levels and only passed upwards when necessary. We want to see trade that supports the well-being of workers and that also keeps within sustainability limits. And we say a blind commitment to free trade is not acceptable. Regards climate change, we advocate a global policy of contraction and convergence in relation to energy use. This means rich countries' use of energy resources contract, while poor countries' use expands, to eventually converge on an equitable and sustainable per capita sharing of global energy, which is designed to keep within 2 degrees centigrade of global warming. Thank you.
Thank you, Alison. Last but not least.
Thank you. I'm the only person here not looking for votes. I'm representing the campaigning coalitions that are organising this evening's event, Stop the War Coalition and the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. First thing to say is that since 2001, Britain has been part of a whole series of military interventions. It used to be known as the War on Terror, and actually it has led to a huge increase in the problems of terrorism and jihadist violence, creating a vicious cycle of conflict, including the horrific barbarism that we can see from the Islamic State taking over and controlling vast swathes of Iraq and Syria. The rise of the Islamic State, has happened in the context, though, of the invasions and the occupations by the West. It's a kind of Frankenstein's monster created out of the war in Iraq, especially, and the civil war in Syria. And remember that the jihadists have relied on money and relied on weapons from millionaire donors, rich donors in Saudi Arabia, that great champion of human rights. And let's not forget that Saudi Arabia is a close ally of Britain and of America too. And British arms companies are profiting from arms sales with the Saudis. And meanwhile, our government turns a blind eye while Saudi Arabia attacks Yemen, as we are seeing at the current time. In Iraq, Afghanistan and Libya, we've seen huge damage caused and massive numbers of people killed. Of course, thousands of Western troops, including hundreds of British soldiers, have died alongside far greater numbers of civilians in those countries. War has also proved obscenely expensive. Despite that, the Tories, Labour and Lib Dems all remain committed to spending up to £100 billion on Trident replacement weapons of mass destruction, if they're ever to be used, that really serve no purpose. And as the queues for the food banks grow, as our public services are eroded, it's grotesque to see such vast spending on weapons and war. We've also seen the last government remain a proud friend, as it says, of Israel, despite the massacre of 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza. And also we need to remember the migrants killed in the Mediterranean, 800 or so of them in the last week, are also the victims of war, like the war in Libya from 2011. So just finally, urge whichever party or parties form the next government to change things, to scrap Trident and instead invest that money in jobs and vital public services. Stop selling arms to Israel and to Saudi Arabia. Stop the scapegoating and the demonisation of Muslims and of immigrants, and end the cycle of violence that has already done so much damage, especially in the Middle East and in the wider region, and for which this country sadly bears a great deal of responsibility.
Okay, great, thank you very much. All right, so you've heard all the opening remarks. The next job then is for me to invite the questioners to stand. Ask your question, please, exactly as you wrote it. Okay, so once you've got the floor, don't feel tempted to embellish what you want to say, because I would if I were you. And I will then invite the speakers to respond, and this time they only get a minute and a half. Okay. And just to warn you, we're going to go, this time we're going to go first.
They passed it on really well,
wasn't it? Yeah. All right, so, well, I might get to it, we'll see. See if we've got a time. Okay, so I've reshuffled them, Nick, just to let you know, so that they weren't all students first. But the first question is from a student. So Ellie Radcliffe, who is an MA history student at Newcastle, would you please pose your question?
Okay, what role should the UK have, if any, in countering IS?
Go first.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. IS continues to change and evolve, and I think one of the salutary lessons of our engagement with IS is to recognise that there are limits to the sort of the modern framework by which we see war and conflict. There is a relationship, an absolutely intrinsic relationship within IS with religion. And it means that while much of our foreign affairs work can actually be done in isolation of religion, it is simply impossible to do that with regards to IS. What that means is that we can't simply consider this to be a responsibility when we get involved, to be involved in a debate about national limits. I don't want to talk too much about regime change, we might talk about that later, but this cannot simply be about regime change, because the drivers, and there's a lovely quote by Orwell who talks about what Hitler offered people, the drivers behind IS are so powerful that the recruitment is something that we're not going to be able to contest purely by force. So that means that our response has to be multifaceted. It has to be one in which we recognise the limits of what we can do through force. It also has to be one in which we try and reduce the amount of damage done by IS. So I suspect the best way of caricaturing the approach, and it does have to be complicated, is to try and ensure that the IS philosophy dies out. And it has already shown a number of instances where the driver behind it actually tends to be the greatest weakness within it. So a lot of our response should in fact be to restrain it and watch it slowly dissipate. That is a very difficult position to take, because we feel something must be done.
Thank you.
Well, I think there are three ways in which, three roles we have for, if you like, combating IS. The first is in providing humanitarian aid and assistance. And that means actually near the border areas where there are great streams of refugees. And also here, and I think it is a shame, in fact, I think it's terrible that the UK has only taken 90 refugees from Syria over the last year, where France has taken 5,000 and Germany is taking 30,000. And that's a policy that we have opposed. So there's humanitarian aid and assistance. There's also providing support within international coalitions, such as the support that we provided for airstrikes at the specific request of the Iraqi government, and supporting the work, the defensive work that Turkey is doing. But finally, and perhaps most importantly, we have to provide a vision of a world in which mirrors the true Muslim values which IS are betraying in their attacks on innocent civilians and their beheading of captives and their raping of girls and their, what I think is effectively a genocide against the Christian and other communities. We have to provide a vision of a society which reflects and celebrates the real Muslim values of peace and understanding and working internationally, and which therefore subverts the IS call for a war between civilizations, which in effect is does not reflect Muslim values and does not reflect the kind of vision of the world that we have.
Okay, great, thank you.
The question is, what role should we have in countering IS? And I think, as Nick says, it is a multifaceted approach. I think the first thing that I'd like to get across, I think the use of airstrikes would not help the situation. I think it would just exacerbate the situation with the sort of the innocent loss of life, and that just makes a bad situation even worse. There needs to be obviously a way of trying to look at the causes and the reasons why IS are attracting so many recruits. We need to be helping people to be economically more equal, and we need to look at the refugee situation as well, and provide a lot more help. I think the role of the UK is, in a sense, is quite limited. I don't mean this that we should sort of wash our hands of it or not be concerned about it, but I think we definitely shouldn't be going into it thinking that we are going to solve the situation. We have to look at what's happening at the grassroots in the country, and what we can do in a very effective way is to encourage a lot more education around how barbaric biases and try and help people who are perhaps going to be drawn into their influence to counteract that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, yeah. I think we have to start by recognising, as I said in the introduction, it is the fact that the West, including Britain, has bombed other people's countries, invaded other people's countries, and occupied other people's countries that has created many of these problems in the first place. And we could not possibly begin to understand the rise of the Islamic State without the context of the war in Iraq. And not just the war itself, the sort of invasion, but the way in which the occupation created a deeply sectarian state that was deliberately about divide and rule and fueled sectarian conflict that had not been there on anything like this scale beforehand. A lot of the media and many of the politicians like to present what goes on inside countries like Iraq and Syria, something like this kind of timeless, eternal conflict. You always get Sunnis and Shia fighting each other and this sort of thing. Actually, a great deal of the violence and the conflict has increased in recent years under the enormous impact and the pressure of what we've seen with the war in Iraq and what has followed that. So stop bombing and invading and occupying other people's countries is the first thing. Also, Turkey is a NATO ally. Turkey is an ally of Britain. Turkey has left its several hundred mile long border with Syria open and has effectively allowed arms to be passed through to IS fighters in Syria. That border should be closed, and Britain, as part of NATO, and I'd like to see Britain get out of NATO, but it's going to be part of NATO, should be putting pressure on Turkey to do precisely that. And cut off the arms trade with Saudi Arabia as well, one of the other powerful countries in the region. As I mentioned earlier, we've got British companies profiting from Saudi Arabia, and it's not just its attack on Yemen at the present, but its links with IS are a huge part of it. I'm sure that'll come across in the documentary Kate mentioned that's on TV tonight about the funding of it. And finally, it is absolutely essential that we accept migrants from Iraq and Syria and from the wider region. We can see from the tragedy, if tragedy is the right word, more of a massacre of hundreds of people in the Mediterranean, totally preventable. That illustrates what happens, first of all, when we wage these wars, but also when we refuse to launch search and rescue missions. And 6 months ago, the British Foreign Office, specifically decided to no longer support, no longer participate in those missions. That is absolutely disgraceful. I'm pleased to see that Amnesty International has launched a big campaign in the last few days to get that changed.
Thank you. Last but not least.
Thank you. I think we have to start from the basis that clearly IS are doing terrible things. They are a danger to international values of peace, and they are against values of global civilization.
Could you speak up a bit?
Okay.
I can't hear
it. Okay, I shall speak up, yes. I think I was saying that we should start from the basis that IS are doing terrible things. They are a danger to international values of peace and values of global civilization, and we should be very much opposed to that. But in terms of intervention on the ground, no, we can't do that, I don't think. I think the intervention, for whatever reasons, however legitimate they may be, have been discredited and damaged by previous governments. I don't think that aerial intervention can control the problem. It can contain it, but it can only, as we've seen with drone strikes and other places, it can only serve to fuel the resentment and the anger and the alienation of some of the people who are recruiting. So how do we tackle it? It's not something I've got an easy solution for, unfortunately, but I think the way to go about it is to support the articulation of moderate liberal Muslim values, support those international actors and those voices that can help to bring that about. I heard quite a good Moral Maze discussion on this issue a few weeks ago on Radio 4. I know it's not always helpful to take a westernised perspective of what the Islamic world should or should not do, but the point was made there has not really been a reformation of Islam, and a very conservative and repressive ideology can still predominate. I don't think I can preach to Muslims about what it is to be Muslim, but I think there does need to be greater support for those working to bring about a more modern, more progressive, more enlightened, if you like, Islamic ideology, and more challenge to those regimes which are facilitating IS. And on that basis, I support what the Swedish government have been doing recently in criticising what Saudi Arabia have been doing.
Right, thank you very much. I was handed another question just as we were starting this question. So I really would like to try and get through everybody's questions if possible. So just to warn you, I'm going to keep time now, okay? 90 seconds and I'm going to put you off. So, Chi, you'll be first on the next question. Right, Maddie Thompson is a geography PhD student. Would you like to ask your question, please?
Yes, so just where do you and your party stand on research and rescue operation and emergency?
Thank you, Maddie. Well, we said when the Conservative Lib Dem government decided to stop that that drowning bodies in the Mediterranean Sea was not going to stop people trying to escape the war and famine and all the other root causes of this migration. And the idea behind stopping that, I think, was mean, and it was also tragically wrong. And so what we need to do now is to work with the European Union to reinstate the support and the rescue of migrant boats that are in trouble, as well as trying to work with the countries of origin for many of these migrants and the country of departure, Libya, in order to ensure, people are making money out of this. I think it's wrong that we're not supporting continuing the rescue, search and rescue, but this is people trafficking. People are making money off death on an obscene scale, and we should be addressing that as well as the international development support we provide.
Oh, perfect time. Thank you. All right, we'll go this way then,
Obviously, the Green Party was really outraged at the government actions last year when they decided to support the EU policy to scale back on the operations, and what's happening now is just absolutely horrendous. I mean, I would almost call it a crime against humanity to allow people literally to be drowning in the Mediterranean. The reasoning behind it was that they said reducing the search and rescue, said it would discourage people from coming over, which obviously hasn't happened. In fact, apparently there has been a 60% rise. So we need to carry on doing search and rescue. We need to increase it. We need to respond to it. We also obviously have to address the problem with the traffickers. These people are being exploited. We also have to look at, obviously, we have to address the reasons why people feel desperate enough to get into a rickety boat to try and get across to the Mediterranean. I mean, that's absolutely, that's a very fundamental way of trying to deal with the situation. But at the end of the day, compassion, there isn't a price on compassion, and we have to deal with the situation as it arises. Okay. And we have a...
Finish your sentence.
We have an absolute responsibility to allow these people to enter Europe, and we need to deal with them in a responsible and compassionate fashion.
Thank you. Okay, Alex?
Well, where are the refugees coming from? And on the news last night, I heard a report which was listing the countries where the people who've been killed are from. And it was Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Mali, and so on. As the list was going on, I was thinking there's a bit of a pattern here in terms of wars, and there's particularly a pattern in terms of British participation in wars in most, if not all, of these countries. And it is precisely that violence from the West, including ourselves, that has generated the massive refugee problem. There's an article by Patrick Coburn in The Independent today. Nick mentioned the excellent lecture he gave here recently on ISIS. And he says, Libya has now overtaken Sicily, the home of the mafia, as the main locus of organised crime in the Mediterranean area. And he says it wasn't like that before 2000 and 11. And however awful the Gaddafi regime was, what we've now got since NATO intervention in 2011 is a situation where there are two rival governments, two different bunches of people claiming to be the government, no real authority, no functioning government and civil society. We've got different militias running and dominating different areas through force, and this massive increase in organised crime, including people trafficking. And there are some people who are making enormous amounts of money from that. And so we need to stop the wars that generate the refugees, and also we absolutely urgently need to get those search and rescue missions back on and overturn the previous policy.
Thank you. Okay, Greg.
Thank you. Yeah, there clearly needs to be a solution at sea, and the EU needs to review the decision that it took to cut back on the search and rescue. But there needs to be a solution on land as well. There is a constant flow of displaced people coming through North Africa. There needs to be a safe route established by sea to Europe, and there needs to be safe havens established on land as well. Where that is going to be, I can't answer that one for you now. Libya is a failed state run by gangsters. Italy and Malta are receiving vast numbers of people, and they are struggling to cope with the overwhelming flow as well. What I don't think will be a solution is the Australian model of trying to establish some kind of offshore refugee camps, which what is going on in Australia is a disgrace in my view. I wouldn't want to see that adopted by Europe.
Thank you very much. Okay, brilliant. Right, the next question. You are going to do that.
It's got to happen.
Point.
Sorry.
And you're going to do that. I beg your pardon.
No problem at all. Sorry.
It's okay. You said everything you're going to say.
Pretty much, apart from the fact that I understand that actually David Cameron is meeting some of the EU heads tomorrow to address this. There's been an emergency decision to get a bit more money put in to whatever the body's called. What's it called? Frontex. Frankly, this is a policy that's clearly failed, and it is right and proper that heads of the EU countries are getting together to try and work out how to resolve it. I don't think the solution to the drownings in the Mediterranean is going to be the same solution to stopping people wanting to migrate across the Mediterranean itself. So it's a much easier solution for us to find ways to make sure that we search and that we rescue people than it is to actually eradicate the desire. And a lot of this is economic migration. It's in the news at the moment, the human rights, but actually, this has been going on for a very long time. We've had these large camps forming in Italy and Lampedusa and what have you. That's been going on for a long time because people have been seeking economic migration, and there will always be economic migration. So that's a long problem to fix. The first thing that needs to be fixed with some urgency is making sure that we stop these boats from causing the catastrophe that happened at the weekend.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next question is from Douglas Rennie, who is a retired resident of Forest Hall.
In foreign affairs, what issue would you be ready, this applies to the people who are standing for election, what issue would you be ready to defy your party whips on or for?
Good question. Where are we starting now? With Alison, please.
That's a very good question. At this point in time, I can't really think of, this is my honest answer, I can't really think of what I would define, my hypothetical party whip. We're talking about an elected government. I'm sorry. I really am at a loss, as to say. But I do agree with all the Green Party policies, perhaps not every single dot and comma and every single word, but I do very broadly agree with the Green Party policies. So if I think of one, I'll mention it.
Yeah. let us know when you've thought of something. Okay, let's move down.
It's not a cop-out.
I was going to say, I can pass on this one. So I will make one comment, which is I do warmly welcome Nick acknowledging that a particular government policy has been a failed policy on search and rescue. I welcome that, and I look forward
to... It's not
to
a government policy, it was an EU policy.
Yeah. Accepted by our government. Yeah. But I just want to say I do... But I do look forward to repudiating a whole set of other failed government policies before the event is finished.
Right, thank you.
I'll be waiting a while.
I'm happy to say I would. I don't think the Lib Dems were whipped to support the Iraq war. We were very strongly against it, and I would have happily voted against that one. I think it's very difficult to say without knowing what the issue was and what the principles at stake would be, how you would vote on any theoretical, hypothetical issue. There are areas where I think it is possible to criticise or to disagree with your party's policy and to try to influence through whatever means you can to try and change that policy, and I think that's reasonable. There are issues where I do have some issues with some of the aspects of Lib Dem policy. I think one of the big issues I think where I would want to see some change in our approach possibly is on EU expansion. Actually, I do question whether, particularly there is some talk about Turkey wanting to join the EU. I do question whether Turkey is ready to do that at this point, whether that is going to be a change for the better for the EU. I don't know. I think it's important to have good relations with Turkey, obviously, but I question whether expansion and accession of Turkey at this point is the right thing to do.
Thank you very much.
It's a great question, but you did actually give us a bit of a loophole, because you said what area of foreign policy might we turn against the whip. So actually I'm going to turn this around a bit and say there's one area in which, if the Conservative policy were to change, I would rebel against the whip, and that's the role of international development. To me, our commitment to international development is absolutely essential, because it's one of the planks by which we have the right to opine as to how others behave. It's one of the ways in which we improve the world. It's one of the ways in which we're able to say that the way that Britain has a place in the world is not purely through military force. It's one of the ways that, from what I've done and seen, we are actually able to recognise that we've done great work. And I'm mortified. I mean, it's laughable, actually. I'm just ashamed UKIP aren't here, because I think on a lot of policy issues... Actually, the main parties all agree. A lot of policies. It's shameful that UKIP aren't here. It's also shameful they decided to cut the 0.7%, and they were invited. Yeah.
They've organised.
They were invited, weren't they?
They were invited relatively late in the day and were unable to provide someone to participate.
I call that shameful. It is an election. I mean, they're a candidate. Anyhow, that's an aside. I believe they've now spent the 0.7% commitment. They've cut the 0.7 commitment in their plans, and they've decided to spend that 19 times over. Well, frankly, I don't think any of the things they're spending them on are worth it. So I would rebel against the party if it decided to remove that 0.7% commitment.
Great. Okay. Have I covered everybody?
No.
It's okay. I'm just going to say that. I think UKIP should be here as well, but I can tell you, having sat on a number of hustings with them, that the answer to every question would be it's the fault of immigration and or Europe, and often both. Before I was elected, in fact, when I was standing to be the candidate for the Newcastle Labour Party, what I said was I thought the hardest decision for an MP to make is about sending troops in to fight in wars and potentially lose their lives. And I say that, you know, Newcastle in the northeast has the highest proportion of young people serving in the armed forces, you know, in the country. We send a lot of our young people into the armed forces, and so taking decisions about the armed forces putting lives in danger. And so having voted on Syria, the Syrian airstrikes against the Syrian airstrikes, having voted for the Iraqi airstrikes, I can say, you know, that was one. Those were a number of votes where my conscience has taken a lot of time to. Well, in fact, on the Syria, I was very much voting against that. So I'd say that when it comes to sending our troops, and I admire my predecessor's point of not voting for the war in Iraq, and indeed, as I demonstrated against that war, I can but say that I would have, I hope I would have voted against it. Otherwise, I vote in accordance with the interests of Newcastle, the interests of country, and my conscience. And where those three cannot be reconciled, then I would certainly have to consider going against the whip.
Brilliant, thank you. Okay, well, given the reference to UKIP and the fact they're not here, I think it's only right that we now have the question, please, from Tom Smith, geography student.
In light of discussion regarding our future in the EU, would you stay or leave?
Sorry, I didn't hear that quite.
Stay or leave.
In light of discussion regarding our future in the EU, would you stay or leave the European Union?
Okay, Alex?
Yeah, well, Stop the War Coalition and the Palestine Solidarity Campaign certainly don't have positions on this issue, so I'm going to speak in a personal capacity on this one. I think the tragedy in this country is that the whole political debate about Europe has for a long time been shaped by the arguments of the right, by a kind of hysteria about immigration, by kind of xenophobia and so on. And therefore, the more sort of progressive case for saying actually the European Union doesn't serve the interests of the vast majority of people really doesn't get much of a hearing. And I think it's important to recognise that the European Union is very much slanted towards, first of all, the most economically powerful states within Europe, especially Germany, the expensive countries like Greece, and very much geared towards imposing the kind of neoliberal policies that have ramped up inequality, that have led to the imposition, massive imposition of cuts in many countries, most devastating, we've seen the impact in Greece, but many other countries too. And what we need to do is to oppose that EU drive to pushing through policies of cuts and privatisation. That's the absolutely critical thing. Whether in or out of the EU, I think a responsibility for all of us is to oppose those policies. But also at the same time, oppose the kind of right-wing arguments that we get against the European Union, where the likes of UKIP and some Conservatives basically blame everything on the EU and say, you know, this is the problem, and particularly the argument that the policy on the immigration is the big issue. That is scapegoating, that is divisive, and I think we absolutely have to reject that kind of scapegoating at the same time as rejecting the austerity that is encouraged and imposed by the European Union.
Brilliant. Thank you. Greg, please.
Thank you. Yes, as a Liberal Democrat, I think you expect my answer to be yes on this one, and it certainly is. The EU is clearly a very important force for not just the continent, but for the North East in particular. We are a region that is net exports to Europe. A lot of our jobs are absolutely dependent on being active and fully involved members of Europe. Regional development, there's an awful lot of EU funding coming into Newcastle, which is vital to us. Beyond just the North East perspective, though, it has been a framework for peaceful European interaction based on peace and shared democratic values, which, if you go back to the pre-1945 era, the history of Europe in the 100 years or further than that before that is not one of peace, it's one of war and destruction and an awful lot of misery as well. And I think the one point that doesn't come out of it very often in the debate on Europe is that we are in a changing world where the US is a declining superpower, China and South Asia are growing economic forces, and in that kind of in changing environment, I don't think that Britain alone, as a small, relatively small economy of what we're now 63 million people or something like that, I don't see that we can survive and thrive as an entity on our own. I think we want to be part of a wider trade network and to have allies that share the same values as us within the European Union. So I think it's very important we stay in it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Stay in. At least stay in at the moment. To me, the EU is... position on the EU shouldn't be a position of principle. It should be a pragmatic policy. It should be a position where you weigh it on the pros and cons, and I can imagine a situation where it would be right to leave the EU. At the moment, I don't think that's right. It's such a live issue. It is one of those issues where I think it is right that we give that decision to the people, rather than it being something that is delegated by the people to politicians to make a decision on. I recognise the risks that are inherent in that, but ultimately there are times where we need to remember who are the servants and who are the masters. It's interesting you mentioned China. I think there's another country that we should think about when we think about EU, and that's Russia. They are absolutely flexing their muscles, and I think we need to be very, very careful as to how we work with them. And it's worth remembering what the purpose of the EU was right at the beginning. It was to knit the countries of Europe so closely together economically that violence between those countries would be difficult. And remembering that purpose, I think, gives us a great insight as to what the benefits are. Economically, there's no real benefit of being part of the larger organisation. Actually, smaller countries could profit enormously, could prosper enormously. But the economic the value in terms of international security of the EU, particularly against an increasingly belligerent Russia, is something I think is very valuable.
Thank you. Well, I'm a strong supporter of the European Union, both in terms of the ideal and the principle that countries should be able to live and work together effectively and successfully, because we have more in common than we have which separates us, but also practically and pragmatically. The Northeast is the only region in the UK, again, with a balance of trade surplus. We export more than we import. And one of the reasons for that, one of the reasons is actually Nissan, but it's also because we're in the European Union and we have access to those markets. Nissan has a line in Sunderland, it has a line in Barcelona. If we spend 2 years arguing about whether or not we're going to come out of the European Union in the run-up to a referendum, it will send its production work to Spain, where there's certainty of the access to those markets. So in our interest, and there's many other examples of investment in the region, in our own interests, we should be supporting the European Union, but a reformed European Union, because there is a democratic deficit, there is an accountability deficit. If you can all name your MEPs, you are doing far better than I could before I went into Parliament. We need to see, it needs to be a closer link between the people and the European Parliament and the Council of Europe and all those complexities, in order for it to work effectively in all our interests. And just to say, the European Union also supports many workers' rights, so it's not all about international globalisation. It is one of the reasons why we've been able to maintain some workers' rights under a Tory-led government.
Okay, my esteemed colleague over there, I think, wants a
report. I totally recognise the point about the North East, and I think it's enormously to the North East's credit that there's running a trade surplus. The point about Nissan, of course, is that the decision by Nissan to increase the production of work here rather than in Spain was precisely because of the relaxed labour laws. So it's an example of the fact that different legislation might increase levels of inward investment.
Okay. Sorry, I've got to say that. I think it was actually, they said it was because the workers in Nissan here were fantastic and great and had one of the best work ethics. I don't think they actually said it was because of relaxed labour laws.
Okay, we still have to hear from the Greens. Thank you. Would you mind holding the microphone up, please? Because not everyone can hear you otherwise.
Thank you. The Green Party fully supports staying in the EU. We support that there should be a referendum, because we think people should have the vote at the end of the day as to whether they want to stay in or not. The last referendum was back in the 1970s. But we want an EU that sees an end to the neoliberal economic policies that have dominated the EU. So we want to see a greatly reformed EU. In particular, we are greatly opposed to the TTIP trade agreement that is being negotiated between the EU and the USA at the moment. That's a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, which, if that goes through, will have a devastating effect on our public services, especially things like the National Health Service. I think another reason for staying in the EU, and probably one of the most important reasons, is to do with climate change. We have to deal with climate change now. We can't put it off any longer. We should have started dealing with it years ago, properly. And So the EU will be a very important forum to do that. The other thing is, we want the EU to be a force for peace and not for power posturing. So we want the EU to be very careful with the way it handles its relationships with Russia, and we want to see all the diplomacy that can be used in order to help contain what could turn out to be a very, very dangerous situation regarding our relationship with Ukraine and with Russia.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, I've got three questions now that deal with Palestine, the West Bank, and issues around both media coverage of the conflicts and policy solutions to the conflicts. So can I first take the question from Gillian Kester, who is a recent Green Party member?
I'm sorry, I haven't written, you want me to read it exactly, but I haven't got a copy of my question. So
would you like me to read it for you then?
Okay. It's the exact word.
Okay, the question is, what does the panel have to say about media bias regarding lack of coverage of Palestinian suffering due to illegal Israeli occupation of large parts of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? So the question is about how the conflict is covered in the media and whether that is biased, yeah? And ignores certain facets of the issue. Yeah, is that right?
Okay. Yes, that's
right. Right, so can we start then back at that end, please?
Media bias. That's a difficult one. I think there are a lot of different outlets covering the media, whether you just rely on the BBC and Sky News or Fox News or things like that. There are plenty of other sources out there that can give you alternative points of view, and I do feel there are lots of other sources that people can access media if you are informed. But if you are just a consumer of the mainstream media, then probably you may only get one particular part of that equation. But I suppose I, as someone who's politically involved, like to think of myself as someone who is quite well informed and will go out of the way to look for other more balanced viewpoints on international questions, not just Israel, Palestine, but many other ones as well. So someone told me once you should read at least two broadsheet newspapers every day to try and get a reasonable perspective on things, not just rely on The Guardian or The Telegraph or anybody else. So on that one, I can see there are certainly other channels putting out Channel 4 News might not put out the same kind of messages as BBC News on these sorts of things. So I don't know whether there is a particular bias implicit in the question that you are referring to, or whether it's just a case of different media channels cover different stories in different ways. So I think that's a tricky one. I do think that clearly there is a legitimate concern on the part of the Palestinian campaign that the voices of ordinary Palestinian people and the oppression they are undergoing in Israel is something that is obviously clearly concerns a lot of people. I think it's equally fair to say there are a lot of ordinary Israeli people who do have concerns about their security and their well-being as well, and perhaps we don't always hear everything from them either. But I would encourage anybody to try and seek a balanced viewpoint on these things and to try and hear both sides, and that's a classic liberal democrat perspective.
Okay, thank you. Conservative.
I brought with me something that a bit of reading, and it says everything you know about Israeli settlements is wrong. It's just a very good example of the fact that I think many of us don't actually get the full side of it. I mean, the fact that's it. Sorry, that's not. It's just it looks like a heading. It's from the reasonably well-respected foreign policy website. It's an interesting article pointing out that which almost anything that we read, we're going to end up getting a skewed answer on, and that makes me think I'm going to take a different view on this. There's a lot in the world for us to be concerned about. There's a lot in the world for us to be unhappy about. But one of the reasons there's so much for us to be concerned about is because we're starting to learn about it. There's a greater level of awareness going on now than there ever has been before. To some extent, we can be irresponsible and not listen to the things that we have the opportunity to hear. But social media has classically been an example where we're able to understand what's really going on in the world, rather than just what is put out by the media. Some of the work I did in Rwanda are excruciatingly difficult because the newspapers in Rwanda go and get everything approved by the government. because they're so terrified that they're going to get in trouble, that the government says, look, we want you to be a free press. And they say, well, we don't want to be a free press because we might say something you don't approve of. I think what we need to do is desperately work hard with the chance that we have through technology to make sure we have a better understanding of what's going on in the world. And that way, we can chasten, you know, the media, which it's doing a good job.
Thank you.
We could do a better one.
Yeah. Well, as some of you may know, I visited Palestine in September with a group of local Labour people. Actually, I think a visit that was heavily criticised by the Liberal Democrats. And it was only as part of that visit that I really began to understand the full extent of the media. It is definitely a bias, but there's also there's an absence of a reasoned and fully articulated expression of the way in which and the level of the suffering in Palestine and the level of the racism. And I think that was what's most shocking for me, as someone who, for a number of reasons, is a very a studier of racism around the world, if you like, and was very active in anti-apartheid. The level of racism experienced by Palestinians, as well as the suffering in terms of the legal the legal system there and the settlements, etc., that was what was a shock for me. So I think there is a bias. I think there's a number of reasons that for it. There is a bias always against foreign lives as being worse, less than British lives and or European lives. And the many connections between people here and people living, Jewish Israelis, so that their suffering and their fear gets much more of a hearing, if you like, than the suffering and the fear of Muslims in Palestine. There's also a form of Islamophobia. I think there's also a inability to go beyond, if you like, the extreme rhetoric on both sides. You know, there was extreme rhetoric, if you like, to actually go for the facts, because that can take a lot of effort. I mean, I had to go to Palestine, in my view, in order to really understand or begin to understand what's going on. So there is, I think there is a bias, and I think we have to address it by using new media, but also holding journalists to account for lazy reporting and ensuring that lives have equal value. You know, lives have equal value, and their stories should be told. The stories of Palestinians who are suffering racism and violence, as well as the stories of Israelis who are living in fear from rocket attacks.
Thank you.
Well said.
Okay. I agree with a lot of what she said about the. I think there is an inherent bias in, especially in the mainstream media, when we're talking about, in particular, the Israeli-Palestinian situation. I think there's a lot of lazy journalism and not digging beneath the picture. I was particularly struck when the bombings of Gaza last year, how there was a lot of media coverage, but the coverage of what happening in Gaza wasn't given enough footing, enough in-depth reporting about it. And even though on the Israeli side, and I understand obviously the Israelis have their fears, but the military might and the allies that behind them give them a lot more leverage. And so I think the Israeli coverage of the Israeli side of it was given really too much, in the sense that the coverage on the Palestinian side wasn't given enough. So I think, and the other thing about on a much more general sort of basis is that the day-to-day sort of narrative of the impression of people is not really brought out. And we need journalism that it does inquire, that does look behind the scenes more. And I think this is something that has been going on now for a long time. But I think the only positive that comes out of this, though, is the role of social media and how to an extent that is counterbalancing the mainstream sort of laziness, where the stereotypes do tend to get perpetrated.
Thank you.
Well, a great deal of the media presents this as if it's a conflict, an even-handed conflict between two sides. There are two rival sides, Israel and Palestine. That is wrong. It's not two even sides. It's not two rival countries. The Palestinians are stateless. And there is no equality between the military might, funded and armed by America especially, to a lesser extent this country, of Israel, and the poor, defenceless Palestinians. There's no equality between the wealth and the power of Israel as a state and what the Palestinians endure on a day-to-day basis, the misery and the poverty of their lives. There's also no equality, by the way, between over 2,000 Palestinians killed by Israel in Gaza and the thankfully smaller number of Israelis who were killed in that conflict. That was not some even-handed conflict. It was a huge, sustained massacre over several weeks of innocent civilians, over 500 children killed in the space of several weeks. And there is no equality between a systematically racist apartheid state and the second-class Palestinian citizens within that society who are enduring over 50 discriminatory and racist laws and enduring poverty and second-class citizens. And one of the things that's a problem with the media bias is all of the stories that do not get told. And there are hundreds of stories to do with those illegal settlements, by the way, and about what Palestinians suffer for those settlements, those colonies really, on stolen land to be built in the first place. The violence they suffer, the way the olive trees are slashed down, often in front of them, the way that stones are thrown at children, Palestinian children going to school. And when I visited Palestine, we went through those areas. We went past the stumps that used to be olive trees. We met the teachers and the school kids who have endured daily abuse from settlers. So those stories need to be told. And finally, there's no history in the media coverage. There's no sense of where all this comes from. 1948, 1967, and so on. That needs to be put back into the story.
The only reason I'm trying to stop you is because we've got two more questions on roughly on the same issue. So, you know, you can add what I stop you from saying. Okay, next question is Lewis Ancrum, who's a history student at Newcastle.
Is the two-state solution between Israel and Palestine still viable considering Netanyahu's attitudes towards Palestinian sovereignty?
Okay, let's start with you then.
So, I'll make a brief comment on that then, because I've said
my name is Palestine. Have I
someone been mistaken?
I think you have, but can you just repeat the question? I lost it at the end.
Ah.
Is the two-state solution between Israel and Palestine still viable considering Netanyahu's attitudes towards Palestinian sovereignty?
Right, who am I? Who's supposed to be going first?
I think I am still supposed to go first.
Go for it.
Yeah, it is. And because I hope that we live in a world in which individuals are never sovereign over nations. And therefore, I don't think Netanyahu has the wherewithal to ensure that two-state solution doesn't happen. Because frankly, I don't see any option but a two-state solution. I mean, that's a Conservative Party policy, but I still don't believe that there is any way other than a two-state solution. So, on that basis, yes, we need to restrict saber rattling, but bluntly, it is the only way, and therefore it has to be found.
Great, thank you.
Well, as I believe a two-state solution is still feasible, achievable. though the likelihood of it being achieved is reducing, And you're right, Netanyahu's attitude, the things, what he has said, not only about a two-state solution, but what he has said about Palestinians and the way in which he won the election, basically by trading on fear, absolutely, and accelerating fear, that makes it very difficult. But I was just trying to find the name, but I can't. I did read a really good article by a past Israeli ambassador to South Africa who presented this particular sort of alignment as an opportunity to snatch victory, if you like, from the shoulder of the relief, but because of the way in which Netanyahu is alienating some of his previous supporters, and also because, and this is our position as the Labour Party, of the movement to recognise the state of Palestine. Recognition, we've said, the Labour Party has said, and we voted in the House of Commons, to recognise the state of Palestine now. Sweden has also recognised the state of Palestine. A number of countries, Ireland has voted on it, France has voted on it. And I think, if you like, if we achieve the recognition of the state of Palestine, then we may be able to, if you like, alter the facts on the ground to make that possible. But, you know, you're right, the settlements, not only Netanyahu's attitude, but also the 100,000 settlers in the West Bank makes it very, very difficult.
Thank you. Okay, awesome.
Yes, I mean, I was very depressed when I heard what Netanyahu said, that he would not allow the existence of a Palestinian state. I thought it was highly depressing. Unfortunately, he has been voted in democratically. So I think it puts us, the international community, in a very difficult situation. But the two-state solution, I think, is still the only way. And so what leverage we can have to try and progress this, I think it's really extremely, extremely difficult. But to answer the question, I think, yes, that is the only way that we can go, the two-state solution. And it's a very depressing situation, really. That's all I can say at the moment. I mean, obviously, I think it does put more pressure, perhaps, on countries like the USA and the EU about the whole business of divestment and sanctions on Israel. But as I said, he has been, it was a democratic mandate, he was voted in under...
By the Palestinians. The Palestinians didn't get the vote, Netanyahu
did. No, they didn't.
They're the ones that are affected.
But and so it's a highly depressing situation. But we do need a two-state solution.
Okay, Alex.
Yeah, by the way, on Israeli democracy, there's no real democracy in Israel, although it's supposedly the only democracy in the Middle East, partly because of the systematic discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel. But also, Israel occupies other people's land, and there is absolutely no democracy and no freedom for the Palestinians in the West Bank, and it's even worse in Gaza. So, quick point on two-state and one-state solutions. Personally, I'm a long-time supporter of a one-state solution in Palestine, which means a single secular state in which everyone can live side by side. Extremely difficult thing to achieve, but I have to say, a two-state solution has become increasingly difficult and perhaps even impossible to achieve. And one reason is the settlements. We're talking about a Palestinian state, we're basically talking about the West Bank. The West Bank is littered with scores of these Israeli-only settlements, served by Israeli-only roads, with Israeli-only water resources piped to them, and so on. So where is this state? How do you do that? But also, what about Gaza? Where does that fit in? What about the Palestinians living inside Israel? Where do they go? What do they do? And what about the biggest refugee population in the world, the Palestinian refugees, going back in their families to 1948 and the Nakba, which created the state of Israel and created the dispossession of the Palestinians? How do we deal with those problems? And I think ultimately we can only get justice for all of the Palestinian people, not just those in the West Bank, through a single secular state, however difficult that might seem. But I think Netanyahu and his government is increasingly making a two-state solution sadly impossible. The one last thing I'll say is, despite all of those reservations, please do support the moves that she supported in Parliament and most of the Labour MPs supported last autumn to recognise a Palestinian state, because that is progress and that is huge pressure on Israel when more and more countries take that move, and that's something that we should support, and I urge you to support that.
Okay. Right, I've got two more questions here, and then I'm going to... Sorry.
You missed it again.
Be quick.
Okay, right. Our position on this one is that we support the recognition of an independent Palestinian state as and when it would help progress to a two-state solution. That is the problem. Netanyahu is clearly a block to that happening, but he has also been re-elected fairly recently. Where we come at this, I think we have to acknowledge that recognition is not going to solve the problem in and of itself. It's the coexistence is going to be the challenge. Recognition is almost is not quite a token gesture, but it's not a solution to the whole problem. And I think that if you look at as a comparator with Northern Ireland, what we need is negotiations. We need courage. We need concessions on both sides. We need brave leadership. More of the Roban sort of style of leadership than the Netanyahu kind of leadership. And I don't see enough of an international effort and an internationally trusted process to take that process forward. And Tony Blair certainly wasn't the intermediary to make that happen. I don't know if Hillary Clinton will, as she's elected as the new American president in due course, whether she will give a new impetus to it or not. I suspect maybe she won't. And who is there out there to actually help drive that process forward? I think we're lacking some
Millie Van.
Okay, I've got... sorry again for missing someone. right, we've now got 7 minutes, I've been told. We have to, try to finish by 7:30. So there's one more question on Palestine. If we could please keep the answers to that one brief, then we will have time for the one on Trident.
Yeah.
And I would like to ask a question on international development policy, if there is time.
Kate.
Yes.
We should leave the Palestine question.
Well, I'm sorry then to whoever.
Oh, well, come on.
We will try to be very quick.
Yeah,
we'll
give you
very
short answers.
Okay, we'll go for 30-second answers then. Please, your name is Chandra Chopra?
Charlie Chopra.
Yeah, please ask your question then.
Sure. Now that the UK has formally recognised Palestine, what are parties doing to impose sanctions on Israel for the breaches of international law? For example, child prisoners, the building of the settlement, and the bringing down of the illegal apartheid rule, as well as the human rights atrocities committed in Gaza, with arms endorsed by David Cameron.
The UK hasn't formally recognised Palestine. Labour has said that we would if we were elected. The Tories have said that they wouldn't. I still have no idea what the Lib Dem position on it is. I mean, if you'd enlighten us. But there hasn't been a recognition of a state of Palestine, and that's what we want to do in government.
Great.
What about the breach of international laws?
Right, next.
Well, the Green Party we say that Israel should evacuate all the illegal settlements. They should dismantle the wall. They should end the illegal deprivation of land and water resources. They should also repeal the law of return, and also they should abandon their claim to exclusive possession of all Jerusalem. In principle, we do think that sanctions is a way of trying to get Israel to recognise the human rights of the Palestinian people. This is obviously a way forward if we were elected as a government.
Just quickly on behalf of Palestine Solidarity Campaign, the struggle for the Palestinians and the international support for the Palestinians is like a modern-day anti-apartheid struggle, and it is Israeli apartheid with all the racism that goes with that and the violence
that we are opposed to. And back in 1987, this city, Newcastle, gave Nelson Mandela the freedom of the city while he was still languishing in an apartheid jail. At the same time, by the way, as Margaret Thatcher, I think at that time was still referring to Mandela as a terrorist. And young conservatives were going around campuses at that time wearing Hang Mandela t-shirts. So this city certainly has a proud tradition of that kind of anti-racism. The successive British governments have had a rather patchier record, but support the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, in particular put pressure on this government, whichever government we see after May the 7th, to scrap the arms deals, to completely scrap the arms trade with Israel, because Britain was complicit last summer in the killing of people in Gaza, and Britain should not be in any way complicit in Israeli violence against Palestinians in the future.
Thank you. Okay, last question.
We as a party, we are critical friends of Israel. We do oppose their security war. We do oppose some of their tactics. We do oppose their illegal settlements. We do have concerns, however, that some of the calls for boycott would be counterproductive in terms of it will not incentivise Israel to come to the table and make more concessions to progress the peace process. And also it will add to some of the concerns and the fears felt by Jewish people both in Israel and both and in this part of the world as well. There is a lot of sensitivity on this issue. I don't always think that's entirely acknowledged properly.
Okay. I don't know why I was asked to chair this, because clearly I can't count past three. So, last but not least.
I know which bit you want answered. Frankly, if anybody, I said this earlier about Netanyahu, if nobody's above the law, right? If there's a breach of international law, and some people don't believe that international law exists, I do believe international law exists. If there's a breach of international law, then there should be correct and appropriate measures taken, including legal ones, to address those. It's why I'm waiting for Chilcot, because I think, frankly, there's a very big question to be asked about what happened with the Iraq war, and I don't think anybody should be able to duck their legal obligations. That is what we consider to hold us as a nation, as a set of nations, when we look to the bigger polity that actually subscribes to the rule of law. So frankly, and I think that you used the phrase earlier, we were guilty of. I'd wait for the guilt to be found in law, but actually nobody should be spared from that inquiry. And if they are found guilty, they should be appropriately treated.
Okay. Matthew Busby, is that right? Yes, politics and economics student, Newcastle University. Who's next? Who's first?
I think it's Green.
Green's me. Green Star. Can we try and keep to 30 seconds again?
2 seconds, no.
Well, the short answer is no, we can't morally and economically afford Trident. We don't need Trident. Trident is not going to answer the big issues that we face today, with the massive inequalities within nations and between nations. I think also we could spend that money. There's 100 billion that's been supposed to be spent on Trident over the next 30 years. We can think of much, much better ways of spending that money. So, the Green Party, as people probably realise, has always is against nuclear weapons in general, but in particular, Trident does need to be scrapped.
Alex.
Well, the waste is obscene. I mean, how many university degrees, for example, that up to £9,000 a year could be paid for by scrapping Trident? The same people who say, the same politicians who say we can't have free education, say that we have to spend £100 billion on nuclear weapons, which will never be used, and if they are used, that's even worse than if they're never used. You know, spending all this money on things that will never be used. And engineering skills, a couple of people on the panel have mentioned engineering one way or another, being geared towards weapons of mass destruction, skills and people's work which could be geared towards something socially useful and environmentally friendly. Can we not create eco-friendly jobs, a green economy, instead of an economy that is about war and violence and arms. That just seems absolutely ridiculous. We need to break the power of the arms arms companies, the politicians who defend them. We need to stop trying to invest in public services. But also, I think we should go further with some of the military expenditure. Okay. Things like the naval base plan for being located in Bahrain. Absolute waste of money. Exactly. Should be scrapping that as well.
Thank you.
One of the less heralded achievements of the Lib Dems and Coalition was blocking the renewal of Trident in the last Parliament. We didn't support its renewal then. We don't support its renewal on the basis set out on a like-for-like replacement. We can't afford it. We don't think we could ever realistically use it. But I would say, and this might not be a popular viewpoint, we may need some conventional forces going forward to be able to counteract, for instance, Russian incursion into the Baltics or into Ukraine. That is a very serious risk and a threat to NATO. If we do have to have a deterrent, and I think that is certainly debatable, it could be delivered by alternative means and not by Trident.
Well said.
Yeah, conservative.
Well, it's a conservative policy, it's also a personal policy. First of all, yes, absolutely, we hope these things are never used. But deterrence is, to some extent, use. The very fact that you have the tool to make sure that nobody else is going to use it against you or threaten you with it is a use. And it is a vital component of how deterrence works. Imagine that's not popular. As a cost, it's only, I think, about 5 or 6% of the budget. The defence budget, absolutely. It's a very small amount of an already shrinking defence budget. We are under, or we're on track to go under, our EU contributions anyhow. So frankly, if you're talking about it wasting money, or about it being money ill spent, you'd either have to renegotiate your position with the EU as to what we're supposed to be spending, or you're going to be putting that money into conventional weapons. Frankly, for what it provides against the threat from Russia and all the rest of it, I suggest that's a useful component. It's interesting to see what will happen with Faslane, of course, with Scottish nationalist power. Little stat. We're dropping in expenditure. Russia has doubled since 2004. China's tripled. Saudi Arabia has gone up by 150% and is now spending more on defence than us.
Okay, thank you.
I'm a strong believer in nuclear disarmament on a multilateral basis. I think the question you have to ask is what will make the world safer. I do think, and I think the idea that we can just say, oh, you know, we're not going to have it. That means, yeah, that's fine, that's great. Our hands are clean. We're never going to be able to be accused of having nuclear weapons. When there are nuclear weapons in the world and the world is unsafe, we have to ask what will make the world safer. And I believe what will make the world safer is multilateral nuclear disarmament. As part of a multilateral nuclear treaty, and if only for that reason, then we need to be able to maintain it.
Okay, I'm going to abuse my power as chair and ask a question, and I'd like a one-sentence answer, please, from each of you. And my question is, Britain's place in a troubled world. It's not just a troubled world, it's a globalised world, in which Britain is part of North-South relations, and not just you know, geopolitical relationships. So I would like to know how each of you would answer the question, what would your party do to make the world more even? Not just safe, more even. Okay, what would you do for greater equality in the world? Yes, please.
Right, I think inequality is one of the hugest problems globally, including in this country. And to address that, it does mean taking more from the rich.
Exactly.
Through taxes, through closing the tax loopholes, through getting the tax dodgers, and having some start taxing the rich in order to redistribute wealth to serve the needs of the vast majority.
Thank you. Okay, Lib Dems?
Well, obviously we're proud of having achieved 0.7%. We can try and push that further and go, you know, try and raise that level still further. There is clearly a major issue internationally with the inequality of distribution of resources, whether that's wealth, whether that's water, whether that's health, whether that's lots of other things as well. And so it's a question of keeping that process moving forward faster and faster. And this is, again, a slightly controversial viewpoint, but to do that and to be able to fund the good work that we are doing internationally, we do need to have economic growth to make that happen, to be able to share that out more fairly and more evenly than it's been the case so far. So we'll keep on pushing on that one.
Great, thank you. Conservatives?
I think rights to your own national resources are important and need to be protected. work I did in Rwanda, there was a large charity that was about to run out of money because it had a three-year grant from DFID, and DFID were very very regimented about not releasing that money for more than 3 years. We got 1 year stay of execution in which we turned the charity into a profit-making entity that was a not-for-profit but self-sustaining entity. I think that's a small example of what we need to be doing around the world. Aid is important, but it needs to be through development rather than handouts.
Thank you. I think there's certainly the 0.7% of GDP going into international development, which Labour brought in, is a very important way in which we can contribute to stability and equality in the world. There are a couple of other ways. We've got to make sure that international companies respect the rights of people around the world, not just in the Western world, and that they are transparent about the ways in which that they are contributing to equality or inequality around across the world. Because I think I don't want to say that companies shouldn't be investing in developing countries, but at the moment, not enough of what of the returns on that return to the countries in which they are, and we've seen the way in which there's tax avoidance. And the other way we could contribute to that is to maintain ourselves as an open country, which, for example, enables and allows students to come here to study. To take students out of the immigration figures and the immigration cap, which the Tories operated, and to use our, soft power as one of the world's leading higher education deliverers to support a greater understanding and greater equality across.
Brilliant.
Last word to the Greens.
The Green Party thinks that it's obscene the inequality of wealth between the richer and poorer nations, and there's a number of things that can be done. We would support global efforts to develop a fairer global tax system. We want to see real action to end tax evasion and avoidance. We want to see poorer countries being helped to cope with climate change. Climate change is severely affecting poorer countries, and we owe a climate debt because of the high emissions that the UK and the other so-called developed countries emit, and so the consequent climate damage that follows. We have really a moral obligation in that respect. Also, in Africa, the G8 have formed an alliance called a New Alliance for Food Security, which we are highly critical of. So we believe that the UK should stop funding that alliance. We even are looking at investigating the potential for a global minimum wage, which would help end worker exploitation.
Okay.
There's a lot of imaginative ideas there, which I think the Green Party, given the chance, would like to explore.
Thank you very much. Wow, that was fun, wasn't it? I've managed to run 9 minutes over time, so I hope you'll forgive me. I'm going to stop the discussion there. I'm sure the candidates would be willing to hang around and chat with folks who haven't had a chance to speak to them. I believe there's refreshments outside. Are they for us? Okay, take your glass of water and head off outside. So can we please thank the speakers very much for coming.